it's a tension, you know. It's a tension of kind of being a native son and coming back and feeling like a stranger, but yet feeling like this is still, you know, your body, or this is still your neighborhood.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Antonia Cerejido, in for María Hinojosa. Today, poet Willy Perdomo comes home. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, New York City was undergoing a moment of intense change. It was the golden age of hip-hop. Whose world is this? The world is yours. But it was also a time in which communities of black and brown New Yorkers were seeing the effects of both the crack epidemic and the decades-long war on drugs.
Steve Young reports on a new kind of cocaine called crack.
Last year, we had over 2,000 homicides here in New York City. That's an average of 5 or 6 homicides a day.
This is the East Harlem that Willy Perdomo tries to wrangle with in his newest book of poetry, The Crazy Bunch. Since the 1990s, Willy has been known as a poet, performer, and writer with a special interest in the sounds and sights of the city he grew up in.
And it's gonna be like two church boys talking loud on the train, praising the Lord in a Spanglish hip-hop speak. Pero que son!
That's Willy on Deaf Poetry Jam back in 2001. His most recent book focuses on a weekend in the lives of a group of young men growing up in Harlem, some of them based on characters from Willy's own adolescence.
Basically, this is all my neighborhood, but most of the book takes place in, you know, what are we on, 120? Yeah, we're right around, you know, where everything happens, basically, where I grew up.
Along with producer Sayer Quevedo, Willy and I decided to take a walk through his old neighborhood to hear some of his work from his newest book and reflect on his teenage years growing up in Harlem, even the not-so-memorable spots.
Does this block have a particular significance for you?
No, not really. This is 117th Street. Not really. I mean, all these neighborhoods look different to me. Like, this building right here is just, you know, I would have never imagined a building like that would just go up in this neighborhood.
What does it look like?
Right now, it looks like a stencil.
Since the 90s, many people have left the neighborhood because of rapidly rising rents. Willy himself moved out to New Hampshire in 2013. And over the last several years, East Harlem has seen, like many parts of New York, an influx of developers, as evidenced by the shiny new condo we're standing in front of.
It's way out of place. It seems like an anomaly almost, you know? But it seems like it's trying too hard too, you know? So. So we're going this way. So this is where I grew up, 115. East 122nd Street. The whole world really existed on this street. This is where I learned how to play cards. This is where I saw my first gun. This was everything. This is where I started thinking about becoming a poet. And this is where I wrote some of Where a Nickel Cost a Dime on my good old-fashioned Olympia electric typewriter that I was my only Christmas gift for 1985. And you could hear me at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. All you hear is clack, 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 ding, clack, 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 clack. That's all you hear. That's all you hear, you know. So in the back, we play stickball. And then this building came up and it had a nice basketball court. They called this 1990. Now they call it the Smiley, I think they call it. Like, it has a whole new fancy gentrified name now.
The Smiley.
The Smiley, I think it's called. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So now eventually what happens in a young brother's life, really, you grew up here, if, you know, if that's your trajectory, we're not gonna say for all young brothers, is that basically you make your way from the stoop and you make your way to the corner. And in the corner is where you start learning all your lessons, you know, about manhood. I'm not sure if it's the same now, but it was like that back then, you know? We can go left here and then come back up.
And this is the corner?
No, I'll tell you the corner. We're about to walk up in the corner. This is one of the hottest corners. In fact, you know that Lou Reed song where he says, when he's going looking for the man? This is where he ends up. 123rd and Lexington around there, looking for his man, for his connect.
I'm waiting for my man.
So this is where everything was. Everything. There was a Cuban man named Julio who had a video game shop in this little store coming up here. But, you know, this would be filled with people who just lived in the neighborhood and kids and all that. You know, there was commerce, there was traffic, there was music, there were babies being born. And it seemed like such an electric place, so electric that I could see it coming out the train station on a summer night. I could see this block shimmering, basically. That's what the way it felt like. But maybe because I was so excited to come back, you know. Why is that? Well, because the closest thing you knew to family was here.
The Crazy Bunch is the story of one tragic and life-changing summer weekend told through the eyes of a crew of friends. And it's modeled off of the memories and stories Willie grew up with. His work is reflective of Harlem culture and the figures and places that made it what it is. An attempt in some ways to preserve a place and time that no longer exists.
I read that you said that even though the buildings are the same, when you come here, the faces are completely different.
Completely, yeah. I mean, there's something ghostly to that, right? Like, you're used to seeing certain folks on certain corners or sitting on the stoop or being in front of a store or in the store or walking down the avenue, and those kind of moments now are few and far between, but it's a tension, you know? It's a tension of kind of being a native son and coming back and feeling like a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, feeling like this is still, you know, your body, or this is still your neighborhood, this is still your block. And if someone were to doubt that, you would have enough stories to tell them.
Actually, can we read the first poem?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure. So this is the, it's called In the Face of What You Remember, and the title is taken from a Langston Hughes poem. And the first stanza in the poem was the first that came to me when the book started. You remember that was the summer of up rock, quarter water, speed knots, pillow bags, 2 for $5, Jesus pieces and bamboo. The Willy Bobo was turned up to 10, and some would have said that a science was dropped on our summer. The summer that was lit with whispers of wild style, rock steady battles and white party plates made all kinds of moons on the playground foam. The summer the burner was used to eat and mandate, inspired Sunday sermons, became a literary influence with humming climaxes, a bribable tale, a dub tied to a string, and squashing beef wasn't an option. The summer of fresh shrills and a future somersaulting off a monkey bar, a future placing bets that all us old heads, desperate to find a new cool, could not flip pure. That was the summer that our grills dropped to below freezing. Back then, Palo Viejo was thermal and therapy, bones were smoked in the cut, and you had to expect Jungle Jim Giggle to be accompanied by a buckshot. That was the summer Charlie Chase hijacked megawatts from Rose's kitchenette, found gems in a milk crate, spun his 1 and 2s below rims that still vibrated with undocumented double dunks. The same summer we became pundits and philosophers, poets and pushers that we all tried to fly, but only one of us succeeded. The summer that Papu turned up to extra status, the only one in the crew who had reduced fame's window by a fifth when the camera panned his Cazal-laced up rock in the Roxy scene of Beach Street. One could say we gave the block gasp and gossip, body and bag, a folktale worth its morphology. That was the season we had reason to rock capes and wings, chains and rings. Some of us flew higher than most, and tricks were hardly ever pulled from a hat. All that and a bag of barbecue bonbons was enough for at least one of us to say, I'm straight.
Did you always know that you were going to be the storyteller of your group of friends?
No, I think that happened as a result of first listening, you know, and just kind of being an observer and then trying to relay what I had just seen to on paper, you know. I think the storytelling really came from my mother and just kind of in the living room, and she loved telling stories about things she saw it seen on TV. The old days at the Palladium, hanging out to the break of dawn and then even after. So she was always full of stories, but I think, you know, I grew up around some really great storytellers, I think. And the storytelling process was a part of their bodies, you know, so people were always talking. That's why I like to walk and talk, you know. And so that was part of it. I think storytelling kind of also gave me a way to access my imagination in a place that was sometimes a little bit too real, you know, in a way that I could not process.
Well, one thing that's interesting about this poem is I get the sense that sort of the different people in your crew kind of like played roles. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, like, even when this happened to the setting of, I mean, at what year would you say this book took place?
It would be like in the 90s for sure. And something that really needs to be emphasized is that the book is kind of a work of fiction before anything else, you know. And while it's based on some images and the language and the vernacular of its time, you know, that should be emphasized, I think. But the idea of living in a tribe, and in this particular instance, the tribe was, for the most part, a male tribe. And so what I started noticing is that everyone had a strength. There was kids who could run fast. There were kids who were like Romeos to the max. There were kids who could fight. And it's weird to find yourself in that kind of dynamic and not have a single strength that you can point to, you know? Except that you were like a bookish kid, right? So that you were by default considered the smart kid, you know?
Well, that's definitely a strength.
I think so, but it wasn't considered one in that domain, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when I became a poet, the beautiful thing about becoming a poet was that I wasn't shamed as a result of being a poet, you know? And so everyone that I was hanging out with at the time really celebrated the fact that I was a poet. You know, that's the kind of role that started to develop. And, you know, and also being in that space where you're seeing things that someone else might not be seeing, right?
Mm-hmm. When you ask that question, do you have an example that comes to your mind?
So there's one time the image comes up and I was standing on a corner and this man walks into the bodega with a cactus on his head, you know? And I'm standing on the corner, I look, and he just kind of scurries right into it. And I'm like, this is kind of an odd image.
Willie's poetry is thick with vivid imagery and confronts some of the harder aspects of growing up in East Harlem in the early 1990s, including the violence he witnessed growing up. In a poem from his book called How It Went Down, Willie alludes to a shooting from his teenage years.
This is how it went down. A man walks into Gaddafi's with a cactus on his head. This sounds like the beginning of a joke, but it's not. We called him Gaddafi, but his name was Domingo. We called him Gaddafi because he looked like Gaddafi. The cactus wanted 3 for $10. When you take shorts, you can only take as much as been took, but when you're taken, then you need to start thinking about what they're calling theirs and what you're calling yours. The car that suddenly pulls up is more delivery than package, more end stop than ellipsis. The dreads sit there and perch there and chill there and lamp there and chill there and rest there, still there, word, they don't move. Nesta let the dreads know that nothing was happening, even though he just opened up. Petey says, I heard those cactuses never died. They say that getting shot is a scene study where all your reward circuits go blank. You only remember the blast, the smoke after the blast, the nanosecond after the smoke, and then you remember the cactus, untouched, sitting on a stoop, still there.
This is a book that deals with death.
Yeah.
And with trauma. Why write about these particular instances of violence and trauma?
Yeah, because they were a signature, I think, in my own coming of age. I think I've always wondered what the effect of seeing that kind of violence had on my generation now that we all are turning 50, and you know, and how is that showing up and our approach to living, you know? There are a generation of Black and Puerto Rican men who are the age of 50 and over who are probably suffering from some sort of post-trauma based on all the ravages of the drug war, you know?
When you say post-trauma stress or how did that manifest for you?
I think some of it was that, you know, it manifested as a part of my silences. I think it manifested in my need to dream a little bit more, my need to escape a little bit more. It manifested clearly as a younger person. There's a level of self-destructive behavior that's not the most healthiest. It could be anything from eating a Big Mac to drinking too much rum. It shows up in your body. It shows up in your sugar. It shows up in your cholesterol. It shows up in the way you perceive things. It shows up in the way you have arguments with folks. It shows up on the way you might get angry for no reason. So I think the manifestation is a multitude of ways, you know, and how it shows up. And sometimes, if you're lucky, you can kind of use your art to think about it. So the conflicts that maybe you could not play out in your existent life are conflicts that you might be able to play in your creative life.
Willie continues to write about Harlem and visits when he can. He's the recipient of a Pen Beyond the Margins Award and the author of several books of poetry, including his most recent, The Crazy Bunch. This episode was produced by Sarah Quevedo and edited by Sofia Paliza Carr. The Latino USA team includes Fernanda Camarena, Miguel Macias, Maggie Freeling, Genesia Mocha, and Sarah Quevedo, with help this week from Jeannie Montalvo. Our engineers are Stephanie LeBeau and Julia Caruso. Our production manager is Natalia Fiedholz. Our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow is Jess Alvarenga. Our interns are Lucas Southard and Jonathan Cabral. Our theme music was composed by Senia Rubinos. If you liked the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our executive producer is Maria Hinojosa. I'm your host this week, Antonia Cerejido. Join us again next time, and in the meantime, you can find us on social media. Adios!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Wincote Foundation.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk to you again.
The world is complicated, but knowing the past can help us understand it so much better.
That's where we come in. I'm Rand Abdel Fattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
I'm Antonia Cerejido, and next time on Latino USA, two music stories from two different generations. That's next time on Latino USA.